in two mystery classes in the Department of Epidemiology, over 600 papers, and a true leader in CBD epidemiology. And we're delighted to have him here today to talk about prospective cohort studies in endangered species. And we would love to have this be an open discussion, so we've got some microphones. We're actually trying to record for some colleagues that wanted to be here but couldn't, that are in Kannapolis. So if you could ask questions at the microphones, that would be great, and I will turn them on if they're not on when we get to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction, and thank you for having me. Happy to be here. So what I would like to propose to review quickly is a topic, some recent developments in our field that intersect public health, research methodology, how we train the next generation of scientists, and research funding, and what we might even consider our research agenda. Three things. But let me first begin with some disclosures. So we understand that if all goes well, this is being recorded. So I need to alert you to that, to be on your best behavior. Members of the audience who prefer not to be in the recording can opt out or let me know. And make sure you participate in ways that immortalize you in the way you want to be seen. But the recording will be available on Sakai against the waiver or something like that. This is the first time I've done that. It's a little more complicated than I thought. And the URL is there. We'll be happy to. Laura and I will be happy to work with you if you wish to have access to this. If by the time you finish, you decide you don't want it. And the other disclosure. We're not going anywhere.
Try escape.
Yeah.
No, press the escape key.
And the other disclosure is, of course, received research funding from NHLBI and Canadian. So, to the subject. Large cohort studies, of course, have been the workhorse in cardiovascular epidemiology for years. And NHLBI has set this up starting in the late 80s and kept implementing over time. And to many of considerable surprise, they have kept going, perhaps contrary to anticipations. So what have they accomplished? They have contributed to the identification of modifiable risk factors and arguably to the remarkable decline in cardiovascular disease mortality in the United States. To wit, between 1960 and 2000, life expectancy in the United States increased by 7 years, and 70% of that change is ostensibly attributable to fewer cardiovascular deaths. That much we know. So how did this come to happen? Presumably following the sequence of observational studies, cohort studies, clinical trials, we learned a lot about what drives cardiovascular disease. How does this result in changes and reductions? Well, we collectively as a community, we claim that this is mostly attributable to three main factors. Specialized medicine, high-tech medicine such as acute care, revascularization, defibrillators, and the like. Low-technology medicine such as management of blood pressure, cholesterol levels in clinical settings, changes that have occurred in parallel over time. And behavioral changes, lifestyle choices that translate into healthy lifestyles such as cigarette smoking, diet, perhaps a little bit of physical activity. We don't know that, we can be optimistic about that. So that's pretty much the background of what we think may have been happening over the course of these decades. So against this record that we point to as being mostly favorable and successful, questions have come up and keep coming up as issues such as, how much, what has CBD epidemiology done for us? the answer for many people and from the Harvard and Blood Institute was shown there, much benign. Good reasons for these questions, and certainly a logical answer. I'm lost in there's a logic to the answer we received. So if you did so well, why is it that cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease still account for 41% of all death? Why do evident disparities in cardiovascular health still exist by race, by socioeconomic status, by geographic area? Core studies have been documented this, and surveys have been documenting this for decades. And the question is, why do they still exist if we are collecting the community that are so successful, have been so successful? Added to which, concerns about innovation, are these core studies really innovating? And second, they're darn expensive. What can we do that? Can we afford? So, I should notice, calling to your attention, the reference at the bottom of the slide. This is no less than the director of the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute Division of Vascular, epidemiology biometry branch. This very organization that is the main channel of funding for this course. So let's say they had some questions. Now, to bring this back to our current setting, the cohort studies are being used here almost as a paradigm for research. Powerful study design, difficult and complex to implement logistically, but basically essential to find unforeseen consequences and associations. They do allow us to determine whether the presence of an exposure more likely precedes the hypothesis outcome or a change in one precedes the change in the other. They help us capture within individual dynamics and between individual differences over time. Those are important features of study design. They help us exercise better control over some common sources of confounding, given the longitudinal or prospective nature of the design. And I would claim that they're literally indispensable to identify etiologic factors for disease. Yet the value of cohort studies being questioned, and as I mentioned before a moment ago, the criticisms are expense. They drain a lot of the budget. Possibly to the detriment of other studies that may be more innovative, that may be more critically needed. And they contribute small incremental knowledge, they have limited innovation, and they have failed to address, or they are failing to address, questions of greatest impact. To what degree are these fair, appropriate criticisms? I think it's something we should consider. The design typically for most of the course large cohorts, well known to us, funded by Heart, Lung, and Blood, specifically here. Baseline examination, induction of a meaningful population, allowing for some inferences to a source population, hopefully. Need not be a random sample, but a meaningful chosen population. Baseline followed by repeat examinations, how many, that's typically matter of funding and this thing, with ongoing surveillance, if you will, in the epidemiologic sense of development of outcomes, events, and perhaps some changes in lifestyle. So repeat examinations and ongoing follow-up, usually in a very cost-efficient way, postcards, phone calls, that kind of thing. And if you can afford it, extensive network of outcomes assessment, hospitalizations, that kind of thing. Follow-up, mortality follow-up is straightforward and easy. A little bit of background now. Since we're referring to criticisms coming from NHMBI and questions, I think it should be noted that investigator-initiated research, your grant indicators, your R1s, make up for 80% of the extramural budget of the engine. So 80% of the growth in power plants from this part of, from the get-go. Historically, these cohorts we're talking about, initially I cohorts, have been funded as contracts. They have been funded as contracts because they're very expensive and they're attempt to do research that other ones typically cannot deal with. It takes a megalomaniac to submit a grant application for $50 million, $20 million. It's not an easy position to do. So the NHGBI has typically had this dichotomy. R1s in contracts that NHGBI sets out with a clearly defined research agenda, it's contract research, thou shalt perform. And the research agenda, the contents, the aims for these contracts are defined with input from the scientific community. So at the start of the contract, proposals are submitted, and they're reviewed. There's peer review. Then you all participate in peer review of what is proposed, what are the responses to for this contract. Coordinating center, also review, laboratories, also review, and so forth. So once funded, these cohort studies undergo contract renewal and stages, and at each time, at each point, they're going review. So it's not that by virtue of being contracts, they're free of input from scientific peers on the contract and the review. And yet, contract cohort re-examinations that we do expensive hypothesis examination components such as imaging or modalities that require instrumentation, a physical setup, and others, lots of money. And in that sense, it's very difficult for a R01 or a series of R01s to tap into that study question if that's what it needs. At the same time, historically, each of these cohorts had incorporated additional examinations. These are hypothesis-driven, investigator-initiated activities, R01s. It says, you do your cohort study, I have a great idea, I'm going to add this one to your examination. That's what we typically call ancillary studies. And they build on what the cohort has and what the cohort is doing on the contract to NHGBI and the coordination. And they add these additional hypothesis-driven questions. And then they make them small, large, short. So they're a great opportunity for innovative research. So that has been happening. And predictably, over time, each of these cohorts has become more and more valuable in the sense they contribute. They accumulate that database, which is amazing. And not only do they have their own cohort with their contract-related study questions, but all your contributions to R01s are now embedded there. So as a reviewer, as a researcher, you can say, oh my, so-and-so did this ancillary study based on the SOL cohort, on the cardiac cohort, strong heart. That's what exactly what I need. That's what I need. And you don't need to, you can draw on that resource. And this is available. Investigators who are not affiliated, need not be. That's now embedded in how the data are collected. Very valuable resource. So back to the question, how much has epidemiology done for public health? We heard much and not enough. And also, is this specifically, is the NIH investment in CPE cohorts warranted, not only have articles from NHGBI staff in visible journals like JAMA, challenging scientific community. Give us an answer. Do you think you're doing okay? Do you think what you're doing is justified? So it's a reasonable question, one which we have to address. And as in any field, this prompts questions, what next? And in this particular case, what's next for cardiovascular epidemiology? A short answer, that's almost a puerile answer, is we know, we have learned, if we have learned anything in the last 5 decades, is that cardiovascular disease and its risk factors are preventable. So cardiovascular health can be promoted and preserved. Disease can be prevented. There should be no heart attacks happening. While important etiologic research continues to be important, of course, what we should be doing as a community is a shift now to the application of our knowledge, the translation of our knowledge elements from etiologic research to preventive research. That would be sort of a premise for you to consider. What about a more detailed response to this kind of question? Of course, for something like that to happen, we do have to exercise our ability to be innovative and to have hypothesis-driven research. It relies on our subject matter expertise. We actually have to know what this is all about. And methodologies and sophistication. No surprises there. And input of this kind, contributions toward this need to come from a variety of different sources. Study community, the study participants, stakeholders of different kind, the funding agencies themselves, and so on. How does this come together? It's not easy to have these conversations happen in a meaningful way. We find it within academic institutions, or Dr. Rosenberg's breakfast, German Breakfast Club may have these conversations, but how does it happen as a scientific community? I think we typically rely on and hope to engage societies such as the American Heart Association, groups of that nature, and NHLBI itself, NIH itself. NIH institutes do this on a routine basis. I don't know how often, but it's an ongoing process for most of them, to my knowledge. They conduct strategic visioning cycles. Where are we now? What should the next 10 years look like? In other words, what research funds are going to be available to us over the next 10 years? Addressing what kind of questions? This strategic visioning informs investments in solicitations that originate from the institutes. There are two levels. That 20% of, in the case of NHLBI, is 20%. Funding that NIH staff decide to allocate versus that other 80% that you initiate and say, this is a great idea, I want you to fund it. Of course, the strategic visioning informs both. It determines what's happening in the contract world, but it also influences what's happening in NOTs for research solicitations. Something else that NHLBI did recently, they decided to use crowdsourcing to engage the community on the challenges and difficult opportunities. And this is they did this very deliberately. Put it in the American Journal of Immunology, create this website, ask for input, and specifically wrote a paper saying, these are the questions we put to you, the scientific community. How can we avoid wasting resources for any studies that sort of contribute little incremental knowledge? How can we assure that resources are applied to innovative science? How can we fast and nimble, responding quickly to scientific opportunities? It's one of the concerns once you have a goal going. You know, it takes a while for that to change course. How can we identify prospectively the most important and meritorious studies? So this was published in AJE 2012. And they had this charming vignette at the end saying, we promise this conversation will not be an empty exercise. It will influence the future programmatic directions. Help us, talk to us. Yet, scientific community did not engage. It was remarkable and painful. There were these few contributions, we all saw that, and we were sort of collectively embarrassed, saying, gee, somebody ought to reply. But nobody felt called upon to pontificate, you know, what the research agenda should be for the initial AI. So we didn't quite meet their expectations in terms of response. There were a few notorious exceptions who we know in our field, but most people did not engage with that reply. So given little input from the scientific community, initially we had defined, you know, what's going to be the, our research life for the next few years, basically. And decided that the transformation of how learning block epidemiology should be a process to identify scientific challenges, accelerate the pace of research translation, and for maximum impact, and make population research more cost efficient. So that those ended up being their goals. Impact, efficiency, cost efficiency, impact, and pace of translation. It's clear when you look at these goals, there's some tension between them. There would have to be some adjustments, some judgments, some priorities established. And I would say none of these really, except for the last one, cost efficiency, assures cost savings, which is one of the main criteria. So much of their consideration seems to be driven by cost. Understandably, and the BI staff never knows what kind of budget they're going to get from Congress. And also an assessment of certain principles. And here are some of the remedies that were also published by NHLBI leadership saying, these are the criteria we want you to consider when we evaluate research as a scientific community, as an institute, as a funding agency. It should be results-based accountability. In other words, what have you accomplished? And that as a principle for research. So much of it is apparently cost-driven. The problem is, of course, estimation of returns on investment are not easy to do. It's a major challenge. NHLBI itself and other agencies do have done some sophisticated bibliometric analysis to tell you well beyond how many papers have been published and what's publication and what's the impact and things of that nature. It's hard to do. It takes time, and as a way of quantifying the impact of this enterprise is probably not sufficient. It's probably not the answer. What is the answer? Well, what goals have been achieved, and how much has that translated? What is the impact? Results in impact. One example that's visible and notorious, we want to look at this type of exercise, is the Women's Health Initiative. One of the trials, the estrogen plus progestin trial, has fairly recently been assessed, it was assessed as a model, an econometric model exercise to see what was its impact. Because the same questions were raised with WHI. How expensive has this WHI been? How expensive has it been for the taxpayer and the scientific community in terms of funds diverted from our ones? Easily half a billion, three trials, one observational studies, numerous studies. The E plus B trial was probably something like I forgot the number, but we have the numbers there. So the question was asked, given that we have a clear outcome, given that we have a randomized intervention, and we can study the impact, it's possible to reach an answer. And that would be, as you see on the screen, 4.3 million fewer combined homotherapy users, 126,000 fewer breast cancer cases, 76,000 fewer cardiovascular disease, 263,000 more fractures, etc. Expenditure savings, 35 billion. In other words, $140 impact per every dollar invested. Remarkable, but how do we do that for observational studies? How do I explain to somebody, to my peers, that those three papers I wrote, they're really weird, they're having an impact, but what? Difficult to do. And I'm not sure we'll be able to do the challenge. I'm not sure. I mean, it's a good question. I'm not sure how to answer. So, if nothing else, the choice on the metrics that we have to use for something like this for attribution and contribution, of course, like, I get a lot of robocalls, and they're always perfectly timed. is difficult. So they need to be quantitative, scalable, and compare and comparable. Lag times are a mystery. So how long does it take for the knowledge, new knowledge of everything published in paper to percolate into translation, into application and bedside and so forth? What does this process look like? How to value benefits versus costs? We have the funding agency impressed by how much money Dr. Rosenman is costing them. How do we answer the question, how much money is being saved by the work being done, how much health costs are averted, and how to evaluate social benefits, societal benefits is a challenge. There is an attempt that I would mention there. STAR Metrics is a consortium, government, private consortium, that are starting to attempt to answer these questions or address these questions. Much needed. I hope they can tell us more how to do this. The other recommendation from NCLBI turned out to be refocus scientific questions. the rationale being chronic diseases are complex. Stop looking at individual traits one by one. Makes for great papers, and so on. But are we learning enough? The process is more complex than can be ascertained by the body of hunger. And you look at blood pressure, and you look at waist circumference, and somehow it will converge to something useful. Makes sense, makes perfect sense. These insights emphasize the need for sophisticated study questions, well-designed study, and high-quality data. But it doesn't tell us necessarily how to save cost. But what's necessary, don't mean necessarily cost savings. And there's another set of recommendations that emanated from NIH, which is manage the studies better, make the studies more efficient. And centralization would make things more efficient in the eyes of some. Instead of having distributed centers, you go where the population is, you set up your camp there, you have a field center. That's costly. It's a structure that's difficult, expensive to maintain. As an example, we're pointed to the UK Biobank as an example on how to do research. And we're told, look, it's $200 per study participant. You cannot beat that in the studies that you do here. How did they do it? They managed to enroll 500,000 people, collect biospecimen and some modest profile of traits, behaviors, and disciplines. And we were told, use it as a model. And highlighting the efficiencies from centralizing the conduct of the study, a time-efficient phenotypic characterization, the UK Biobank participant were ultimately assured, if you come in, you're out within an hour, we'll make it happen and fast. So time efficient. And the other feature, of course, is the follow-up. It happens by linkage to the NHS, the UK National Health Service. Wonderful feature. Don't be really good. Instead of that, our goal size has to chase after the participants that are invented, the outcomes of hospitalization, so a little bit of a concern about the setting. The other concern Mark mentioned is if you take a snapshot of biomarkers in this fashion, the biomarkers reflect a very narrow exposure, window exposure, doesn't speak to environment and general sense, doesn't speak to changes in the environment, doesn't speak to, they don't really cannot contribute fully to public health initiative, translation into public health initiative, into policy, or things, elements that have to take into account public health, typically work on public health and choices such as lifestyle, exposure levels, and things that can be regulated. So it's, I'm sure very efficient, but I'm not sure the breadth of information provided is all that great. And the considerable concern about this particular study is they recruited study participants by going to areas where there was diversity. We want people from this state, this characteristic, and went to different regions of the UK. And then they set up a temporary recruitment station, and they basically sent out invitations. The response was between 1 and 10%. Average 6%. So a study of volunteers who happened to be somehow within reach. And the article that I quoted, I showed earlier, actually mentioned that extreme selection bias will not affect internal validity. And selection is of concern only for the estimation of disease frequency, but not for the study of risk associations. That is profoundly somehow I made it through the AJE reviewers, but maybe they were not willing to stick their heads on. Further on, the recommendation was, of course, for stating what we really need is large studies, 500,000, a million participants. But how do you argue for that in the absence of hypothesis? It becomes untenable to say. I don't know what the study question is, but I need a million people to do this. And of course, underlying this is the idea of agnostic research. I have biomarkers, I find associations, but and we'll come up with answers later. So that one was not overly impressive, I think. Added to which, this seems to target very rare exposures. So on the one hand, we have funding agencies tell us, your cohort of 16,000 people is too expensive, but what I need is a cohort of a million to do that. I'll skip the rest because the article also mentions that expertise to maximize efficiency is as important as scientific rigor, which I believe most of us would not agree with. That's not necessarily the work of science. But anyway. So other recommendations also come emerging from initially as the idea to make your studies better. You have to make sure not to miss the boat here when it comes to interconnectedness, the ability to use to capture big data systems and the like. So basically we're told we're not doing enough of this, which would probably create opportunities for science at a considerably lower cost. True, I would venture to say that big data resources are being used incrementally, perhaps slowly, but there has been considerable enthusiasm in the community of epidemiologists to do that. We're still learning. The problem is we don't want to do it just because it's there, so we're learning how to use harmonization. Which is not easy, particularly if you want to have inferential equivalence to make sure that what we actually infer from these data makes sense. So it takes a while. As for wearable technology, again, many promises there, exciting. So far, to my knowledge, it's quite limited here. Nothing overly transformative has happened. It's likely to change. So, I'm not sure that this is necessarily the solution we have to focus on. It's a great resource if you know how to use it. And I hope you learn how to use it, but in the meantime, I don't think it's what would make NIH happen if we say, from now on, we're going to move our attention to big data. Another recommendation from initially was let's make your studies more efficient by combining observational and interventional research. Put clinical trials inside the cohort. Why? Efficiency again. This is a group of people who are being followed, they're easy to recruit, they've shown us that they don't run away from researchers when they're contacted to participate in studies. And they're being monitored. So in other words, the clinical trial doesn't have to create an infrastructure so to follow events and go follow-ups and the like. The obvious potential challenge is messing up an observational study with an intervention. But there are obviously interventions that may be benign, perhaps do not affect the natural history of the process for which the cohort has been designed. And there are some examples like that. I think it can be done. In a few cases, successful. For instance, there's one trial underway, nested within the ERIC study. It's called ACHIEVE. And individuals who had previously been tested for hearing, right, audiometric testing, are now being randomized to hearing aid versus non-hearing aid. And the outcome is cognition, palm-screen, that kind of thing. Seems like a reasonable idea. It was fundable, and the investigators are now conducting this. The expectation is that it will not affect the natural history of other conditions that will be assessing the cohort. So this too is happening, and to some degree it makes sense, but may not modify qualitatively modify the field. And finally, something else that NHLBI did, in addition to tapping their own expertise and resources, they went back to the scientific community and pulled up a panel of advisors, said, you come up with some recommendations to innovate in the field of it. And that group of prominent and experienced researchers came back with a report. The reference is shown at the bottom of the slide. They were assembled in 2013, and their charge was to make recommendations about how the NHLBI can take advantage of new scientific opportunities and delineate future directions for the community. What did they do? I don't want to bore you with too much detail, but just to highlight on the left side of your screen. First of all, they said create a forum on population sciences. If you want to talk about innovating the field, create a forum where this is happening. And it should really admittedly try to create a forum. And we didn't jump in, but so let's try something else. Launch electronic email system. Okay, learn how to use that. Build a data science workforce. In other words, train people. If you're going to transform it with emailology, train people who are able to do that. Fresh thinkers, a new generation of scientists that can push this forward. What else? Develop a compendium, sort of a housekeeping recommendation. Make a list so that help others find all these resources that have been assembled in the area of cardiovascular immunology. Makes sense. It's not transformative, but it certainly would help a lot of people find this, the data they want and need. Integrate the emerging clinical trials. That's sort of a nod in different directions. It's already happening. Why not? And create a cohort consortium. We have all these cohorts, why don't you bring them together? And that, again, has been happening. People are trying to learn how to collaborate across cohorts. Probably something we should come from that. And finally, implement competitive external evaluation of these cohorts. In other words, make sure that absolutely everything we do in cohort research is received due attention through peer review. So again, the notion is investigator-initiated grants should be the predominant driver of this research agenda. So how does all of this converge into what seems to be happening at present? least as far as I can tell. NHLBI has already decided and based and reinforced by these recommendations from this panel, they have chosen, they have changed the model, funding model for corporate studies. So they have now a system in place, which is in place for all of these goals. And for you, all of us investigators, contracts continue to fund infrastructure, which includes participant follow-up, yearly, biannual, whatever, periodic assessments by phone, outcome assessments of this nature, and exam facilities, as well as the management and storage of all these valuable resources collected. Hundreds of freezers full of specimens, records that are shared with other investigators and the like. That continues to be funded by NHLBI. That's what they consider to be core funding. To implement this, for an exam, board exam to happen, another step has to follow, which is investigators have to get an R01 to go through. At least one, usually there's more than one, that builds onto that examination. So the what used to be these ancillary studies that used to mostly tag along and benefit from it have become the key element. You cannot have a board exam unless you have these R01 examinations tied to that. And that's to encourage and enable innovation, new science, by the, from the wider scientific community. So peer review of investigative initiative grants does, of course, emphasize innovation, impact. And if you pass that hurdle and get to manage funding, you can have a cohort examination. So it's a hybrid one. What has happened in the meantime? So this model has been implemented sequentially across all these cohorts and has translated into a very rapid and successful adoption of this new funding model. Mesa, Cardia, Framingham, Eric, it's happening in Seoul now. You name it, they have all adopted a little choice, you have to do it. And in doing it, they have been quite successful. What does it mean? Align a series of R01 proposals and do your very best. So temporary, they also align temporary to coincide with an examination, scheduled examination of the court. So it, the choreography of this has become quite complicated, but it can be done. So as a result of which, there's an even stronger suite now of collaborative, and I would say innovative, and certainly cost-efficient studies around these cardiovascular cohorts that have implemented this model. It's not a qualitative change because we always had ancillary studies, except that now ancillary studies enable cohort study, cohort examination, and they have to align with it. And I would say that now, even more so than before, as a result of all of this, cohort-based ancillary studies continue to provide a very valuable research opportunity and career development opportunity for investigators. So if anything, this has enriched the opportunity for us to learn from and draw on research that's being conducted by cohort studies. So the good news, if you will, after all this argumentation, is that these very studies, they're still alive, and very dynamic and active, and by virtue of this ancillary study schema that has been added, may continue to be a very fertile ground for innovative ancillary studies, and we encourage people to use it. I think that should be it.
Much like the last speech. I think it's somewhere here.
It's like it's on.
Thank you very much. I just want to pick up on one thing you said early on that really struck me, and that was some recommendations about transitioning from etiologic research to prevention research. And, you know, if you really think about that, that's a major change in the way a lot of epidemiologists think and do their work. So I'd like to hear what you think about the best way to accomplish that. Is that through embedding, as you say, clinical trials into our typical observational studies, or should we just get heavy into clinical trials and pragmatic trials and do that big time and embed observational studies within our clinical trials? So what's the best way to accomplish that? But I see that as a major change in a lot of the way a lot of people think in epidemiology, etiology.
Yeah. I quite agree. I think that's more influential and perhaps very transformative than any of the other things that we talked about, which is procedural, how to conduct these studies in a way that become more informative and more cost efficient. What you mentioned is indeed, that would be the major challenge, how to translate, how to make it, how to increase the pace which we are able to implement or put to a test. Through pragmatic clinical trials, all the knowledge we have several decades of heavy researchers. That's not being considered here, other than the recommendations that make pragmatic trials more feasible, easily accessible, and provide an infrastructure for that. It might even take you back to the question saying, well, the focus of this conversation has been cohort studies. Do we need cohort studies to do translation research? Probably not as much. They're wonderfully suited for etiologic research. Now, if we want to see whether change in one or another attribute leads to a desirable outcome or change in something else, we still need prospective designs, preferably randomized, but perhaps need not be randomized. So the traditional cohort study primarily focused on etiologic questions served as well, but it may not be the best answer for what needs to happen next.
I've got a question.
Sarah,
so you mentioned earlier in your talk, thanks for your great talk, by the way. You mentioned earlier in your talk that you think we have a failure to address questions of the greatest impact. I'm curious what your advice is there. How do we anticipate what's going to be important 10 years from now?
Very good question, right? Yeah. That's a responsibility that we all share, I think. That's what we do collectively, and probably the best collectively in terms of hitting up on the innovative, important questions. The solution that emerged panels of advice and NIH staff and personnel and said, introduce more grants, introduce more R1s, it gives people a greater chance for them to propose their innovative ideas. Peer review will play its role, but ultimately we'll see some innovation come from. Are the courts not asking innovative questions? I don't think it is the case. They have been reinventing themselves via all these answering studies. I don't think they are that's necessarily the concern. The concern is that relying on monolithic cohorts to be not the only ones to end it would limit opportunities as scientists, as researchers, to change this field, to move it forward fast. So the more our ones find their way into this, probably the better. Beyond that, people come up with occasionally a good idea. We have to keep praying for that.
Do I have to go to the microphone or can I ask you?
Laura will ask you to pretty please do that.
My question is about new cohorts, and there was a call from NIH and the TOBI about creating new cohorts. Where does that come in the context of cohort analysis?
Yes, fascinating. Thank you for mentioning that. The answer is I don't know. It is very intriguing. The initial year after all this process of completing the circle that we just went through, also launched a
initiative for new cohorts. And the only thing we know about them, they have to be literally fresh in terms of their thinking, design, study questions, they have to be innovative. And there are no other restrictions. It's not, you're not saying you have to do, presumably you have to be hard-lunging by traits or phenotypes or questions of interest to that particular agency group. They don't tell us it has to be lung disease or blood disease or this or the other. It's open, it's wide open. Awards are anticipated, something like $30 million each. One is already being reviewed. Who submitted applications? I don't know. We did not. And the next one is expected for next year. So it's going to be how many of these they will fund is however many good proposals they can squeeze into the $30 million budget. It's going to be very informative to see what has been submitted, but basically the scientific community is being asked to propose new cohort ideas relevant to health, cardiovascular health for the population, and they need to be informative.
I have a question about your thoughts on biobank cohorts like the so thinking about like the new precision medicine initiative, all of us cohort that they're trying to get off the ground, what are ways in which biobank cohorts or volunteer only cohorts can be designed to be more helpful for you know, and more representative? Like, you know, are there ways of doing matching, or you know, if that's the direction we're going, trying to link with EHRs, like what are things that we can do to make the inferences better?
It's a great question, which I will have difficulty trying to give you a useful answer. I think the hope is that at the molecular level, selection bias does not disrupt or interfere with what we estimate as association between one molecule and another molecule. One particular segment or marker on the DNA versus its RNA or its downstream metabolic effects. Fingers crossed. Do we have any evidence that that is not the case? I don't think so, but maybe perfectly suitable for discovery and for characterization of metabolic pathways. How will that impact the field? I mean, we don't want to be in the same position portion now. 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I said, okay, we spent $500 million. What's the impact, guys? What have you done? A lot of good science, but the translation, I'm not sure how. So, how would Biobank, UK Biobank, for instance, tell us how to change the lifestyle? Change of policy or the impact, what impact would it have on the health of us? I don't know. We'll probably 1,000 papers later, we may have, I'm not being physicians, literally, we may have a lot of the science, basic science to learn, but I doubt that it will have an impact on the population. I haven't won. But I think it's a very good
possibility. I just
wanted
to make a couple of comments about that, I think.
Would you like to come
in the back door here? I was just going to make a couple comments about, you know, the kind of cohorts that are biobank driven, because we've done that here at UNC plenty. And I think if you don't go into it with a set of scientific aims, sort of the hindsight part is a little hard to craft. But I think, you know, from DNA, maybe we're in an okay place as far as bias, but the biggest trick there is all the metabolomics and the other components that you want to measure are driven by other factors and exposures that are equally problematic. It may not be a sampling bias, but maybe that the exposures have really change the utility of that information. So we have a big cancer cohort, we have lots of biospecimens about them, but their treatment dramatically impacts anything you're going to measure in their biospecimens. So I think, you know, thinking about it that way, just remember that caveat. But I think another way that these large cohorts potentially are moving are things like the Carolina Translator, which is linking to lots of data sets. So that may be sort of the wave, you know, of the future where you're linking to either lots of biomonitoring or lots of environmental exposures, you know, and capturing data longitudinally. So maybe that at least is a way to think more currently about what we have.
Thank you.